another program of Savoir Faire, the program about design and designers, which is being brought to you by the History of Art Department, University of Malta, under the coordination of Dr. Giuseppe Scambri Bonacci. My name is Melanie Farrugia, and I will be your hostess during these programs. I remind you that you can follow images of what we will be discussing by accessing the following website, melfarrugia.wix.com/savoirfaire. Welcome to episode 7. Today we will be discussing how design affected warfare during the centuries, both in defense and attack, by exploring armor and weapons. To give us more insight on these topics, today I have two special guests with me. We have Franco Navarro, who will be telling us more about the design of armor and decorative design on the armor, and we have Franco Davis, who will be sharing information with us about weapons and various designs in the weapons department. So, hello Franco and Franco. I think I will be calling you Navarro and Davis to avoid confusion. So, let's start by knowing something about you first. So, let's start with you, Navarro.
Basically, I did my dissertation on armor decoration 2007-2010. I concentrated mainly on the decorative designs of the defensive weapons, okay, mm-hmm. basically the armors. Well, as regards to design, I think the first thing to say when we talk about armor is that they were weapons, so they shouldn't be considered literally as works of art or like paintings mm-hmm. or something like that.
Okay, so something about Franco Davis.
Hello. Yes, I finished my master's in hospital studies last year, so I'm still fresh.
Okay. And both of you, University of Malta,
University
right?
of Malta. My dissertation was studying the practical and symbolic characteristics of hospitaller-edged weapons. So mainly swords and mm-hmm. any other cutting weapon. And also with the designs that they would have had as well.
Sounds very dangerous.
Yes.
So, let's start our discussion with the armor subject. So, with the defense, I would say, right? First of all, Navarro, have you ever worn part of an armor or a full armor? I don't know.
Okay, when late Michael Stroud was curator, yes, I tried the Valette armor.
Really?
Yes, and well...
did it fit you?
Yes, it did. So, for the time, the Grandmaster was quite a big man, actually, compared... What can I say? I mean...
Is it heavy as it looks like?
They are heavy, but they're not heavier on most Thor armors, especially if we have to talk about the 16th century. They're not heavier than modern military equipment that today's soldiers mm-hmm. use. So with that, one has to include that knights, all knights used to wear armor, were trained, I mean, to fight literally with the armor, so they were trained to carry that kind of weight.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's not really possible to make many abrupt movements, or, I mean, I never tried one myself, but I can imagine that it's not easy to...
It depends, I mean, well, the armory has a collection that starts with the armors that were brought from Rhodes, no, those were mm-hmm. used for a function, then it developed to those armors we call 1565 armors, the knightly chased armors, the decorated armors are knightly chased armors.
What does it mean?
Armors that belonged to the knights.
Okay.
The other armors that make up trophies of arms at the palace and in other sites in Valletta here in Malta belong to the militia. The militia were the paid mm-hmm. troops, so you have to make that distinction.
So then, the distinction would be that the knight's armor is more elaborate, a better
exactly,
armor?
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. The majority belongs to the 1565-1570, then by the 1580s the shape mm-hmm. starts changing and the armor becomes more lower piece cut, we call it. Now, I don't know exactly
how... Yeah, you
have
to explain it to us.
The lower piece cut, lower on the waist. You know, because then by 1580s, even 1565, they used to wear half armors. Mm-hmm. Some call it even fortification armors, where the feet are not defended because they had to be more agile. They used guns. Gunpowder was already mm-hmm. on by the time the great siege was happening here in Malta, and the sword. I mean, started losing as well its effectiveness alongside the armor. But the sword had a longer life than the armor.
And then we'll hear more about it from Franco Definitely. Davis later on. So, let's start. Maybe you can tell us what a full armor would consist of.
You have the helmet, which 16th century, the Hospitallers type of armor would consist of either a Morion or a Borgone or Borgonetta. The most exemplary full armor we have is the what we call the Verdalen armor. So it's the kind of armor you'd find anywhere in Europe, and it was very used on the battlefield. And the one that Caravaggio painted,
okay,
that's the same one.
And what would it consist of? For example, there are kind of what we call shin guards in football today, for example.
Yes,
these are all separate parts that are tied together.
You have a helmet, which can be a closed helmet or closed helmet, which variates. Basically, the face guard can be dismounted. Then the closed helmet is one full thing. There's the goletta, which covers the neck. Then there's the pauldrons, breastplate, backplate. The pollens, which are the knee defenses. There's quite a lot.
Okay, and these were held together somehow, I guess, right?
Yes, these buckles and rivets, mainly.
Rivets? So someone had to kind of...
Yes, they were riveted, literally.
So to remove it, one had to...
Depends, because at one point...
Get someone else to dismantle.
By the 1570s, you had what we call removable pieces. The removable pieces developed alongside firearms technology. At one point, there was no difference between the cavalry armor, the infantry armor, or assault armor. There was no difference because it developed alongside the gunpowder, missile, projectile weapons. So at one point, you could change any part of the armor. I mean, by changing literally strap with the buckles. That's how it was.
What is the main difference between an armor used for battle and a parading armor?
Well, we have two examples which can be called literally parade armors, but the armors we have in Malta, and I'm referring to the knightly chased armors, the armors that belonged to the knights, like the Damascened armor of Grandmaster Wynyacourt and the Pompeo della Chiesa armor. Those are two parade armors, but both functional for warfare.
Who was Pompeo della Chiesa?
Was perhaps the most famous Milanese armorer of the 16th century. We have quite a good number of pieces. We have the Pompeo della Chiesa armor, which you can identify that by its pauldrons, the shoulder defense, that is. It is embossed with the lion's face.
Okay, so that's like his signature, or?
No. His signature is the Impresa. You find it on the breastplate mainly. And we have various pieces of Pompeo della Chiesa, and that's very important for the armory because, I mean, I remember, for example, the Metropolitan Museum of New York bought a breastplate of Pompeo in 2001. That was such a sensation. Now, when I think about it, in Malta, we have
not many people know much about this.
No, and it would be very interesting to try to match the pieces in other museums or in other collections. Like in Leeds, for example, in the Royal Armories of Leeds, there are various matching pieces with what we have in Malta. I mean, I identified quite a lot, really.
So during the centuries, I guess the shape, especially the front,
it
changes with the clothes style, with the fashion of clothes, or mostly?
Yes, there was a time when it changed with the fashion of clothes, especially when I think about the mercenaries, the lanzonets or reislaufers, which were...
You have to explain when you mention these big names.
Yes, those were mercenaries that fought, for money. And they had a certain way of dressing, basically. Uh-huh. And at one point, armor was being affected by that. That's the 1500s. But the highest point of armor was in the 1400s, when we had the Gothic armor. Missalia, for example, or the Southern German. Missalia were a family of armorers, by the way. And the Southern German kind of armor, where the armor followed literally, I mean, the body proportions, mm-hmm. and it was very effective. Okay, obviously you had to be trained to fight mm-hmm. with that. Then it developed with the piececut shape, and it kept on going low on the waist until the mm-hmm, 1580s. By the 1600s, we get the cuirassiers, which was a heavy, very, very heavy type of armor. So the design changed, the armor became bulletproof, mm-hmm. and the cuirassier was basically trained to fight both with the sword and the guns, the flintlock mm-hmm. kind of pistols and rifles. Well, I'm not very much into the offensive mm-hmm. weapons.
And where, would you say, were the best armor makers, producers?
Milan, definitely, because mm-hmm. you had three main families which produced armors. And there are the Missalia, the Ello, the Negroni. Then you had the Negroli, and we have a helmet signed mm-hmm. with a Negroli emblem on the back.
So they would sign with emblems, not...
Yes, the main exponent was Filippo Negroli, defined as the Michelangelo of steel back mm-hmm. then. Then after that, the Della Chiesa took over. Now we have a Negroli here in Malta, and mm-hmm. we have a Della Chiesa as well. But we don't have Missalia.
And of course, a knight would commission himself and pay himself, I guess, for this...
Yes, that's where the problem comes with documenting armors. First of all, to be a knight, the hospitaller context, to be a knight of St. John, you had to be equipped. So mm-hmm. that's the first thing. So you had to literally buy your armor. And buying an armor, I mean, it's a status as well. So if you're really important... You have to get, it's like buying a Ferrari uh-huh. nowadays, it's just the same.
And
the
more
same
decorative.
Thing. More important, and well, you can die before mm-hmm. as well, like Grandmasters, the Valette's brothers.
So, yeah, let's focus on your major area of study, the design on these armor as a decoration, am I right?
Yes.
So, but there, maybe sometimes there was even more than decoration, maybe the coat of arms or maybe religious
Yeah, well, the religious,
items.
That is the Stoxabit. Kind of decorations, which is sometimes can be referred like an ex voto, sometimes, not always. Then by the 1560s, I would say, developed very much the grotesque style, mm-hmm. which started off 1490 from Nero's basically villa when it was discovered mm-hmm. in Italy. And, you know, Michelangelo, Leonardo, Raffaello, they all saw this kind of decorations and the grotesque type of decoration, I mean, was spread all around Europe, so we find it on armor as well. Those were originally designed on paper, woodcuts mainly. The armorer would get the design and would use the design on the mm-hmm. on the armor. So there was the Via Armorari in Milan, that there was like various bottegas of armorers working alongside artists, printmakers, mm-hmm. so it was...
So you would go there and get the job done?
Yes, yes, it was
having an artist, yeah, having an armor maker.
A product which was alive, basically, mm-hmm. you know, it's like... And in the case of Malta, I mean, to focus on the hospitallers, so you had the grotesque kind of decoration, 1565, which developed to the patterned decoration with trophies of arms. So now we are in the 1580. Mm-hmm. And after that, decoration started being less used, mm-hmm. because the armor needed to be much more heavier, you know, and ready for mm-hmm. any kind of projectile mm-hmm. weapon, basically. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Franco. That was very interesting. And now we'll move on to Franco Davis. And, well, Franco Davis, I don't have to ask him if he ever handled weapons, because I know that he's quite familiar. In fact, Franco, you can tell us more about the Malta Historical Fencing Association, and you're part of it, right?
Yes, I mean, I've handled old weapons, not modern firearms.
No, of course we're referring about swords, daggers.
Yes, I'm a member of the Malta Historical Fencing Association, not sports fencing, it's like a historical fencing. Mm-hmm. It's basically a school which revives traditional fighting, which was done in the past. Our flagship phrase would be the martial arts of the knights of Malta. So it's like the Western martial arts of the time. Mm-hmm. And the main factor of that would be using edged weapons. And then it evolved to using firearms. As mm-hmm. everybody would know, that the sword sort of died down and was replaced by the gun. So we sort of practice sword fighting as it was before sports fencing was born.
And I know you organize lots of events.
Ah, yes.
Events like demonstrations and lectures. So Franco, tell us something about the design of swords throughout history.
Yes, swords, obviously, we've had the sword for ages. I mean, it's from the Iron Age, the sword was born. What I studied in my academic study was the Renaissance upwards, so 16th century up to the 18th. And also, incidentally, what we practice in fencing is also 16th century, we don't go before. But you have Roman swords, you have the medieval Crusader swords of Europe, you've got the Asian counterpart as well, which is different. But let's speak about the European sword in Malta, the knights. They evolved a great deal. I mean, in the Crusader times there was a normal cruciform shaped sword, the long sword. Or before that it was the one-handed long sword, so to speak. So it's held with one hand, it was quite broad, and usually used with a shield. By the 16th century, even in the 15th, the double-handed sword existed. Incidentally, that's an evolution along with armor, because when chainmail existed, it wasn't that effective. So a knight had to use a one-handed sword on one hand and a shield to protect as an addition to his armor. When plate armor was invented, you could strike a knight as much as you want on his plate armor. You won't do much. So the knight could afford to use one sword with two hands. So the shield slowly started to not be discarded, but used less, so to speak. In the Great Siege, the double-handed sword was used, not by everyone. You had to be specially trained, because a sword is a very, it's a simple weapon, but it's very complex to use. You couldn't give it to troops and tell them...
Without training.
Without training. Pole arms maybe were a bit more simple to use in a group position.
Pole arms
are any edged weapon, any nasty blade stuck on top of a pole. Usually the pole would be 5 to 6 feet, sometimes 12 feet. A pike, what we call a pike, is a very long spear against cavalry. And a halberd is what lots of guards, the Swiss guard of the Vatican, they hold the halberd. And that has a spear on the top and an axe on the side. A polearm is quite nasty. a sword was considered more noble and more elitist. And needed more training.
And I guess along the centuries it evolved, for example, maybe there was protection for the hand.
Yes, yes. The long sword, for example, it has a simple cruciform, it's a cross. And it holds from the handle and there's a cross guard to protect the hands. And any part of the sword can be used, even the pommel, the part at the bottom. Eventually, in the 15th century, sometimes even before, you see treatises and pictures where the knight would hold the sword with his finger above the crossguard, so his finger would be exposed. He'll practice his fingers on the blade. And when you do that, there's much more control in the sword. One would have to hold it to realize. Obviously, with design, someone had a very bright idea to protect that finger, because it doesn't make sense to cut your finger off while you're fighting. So the rings started to develop around the guard. And that's what, cut a long story short, what you see when you see a rapier today, which is that those fine rings around the hand grip.
Just to make a quick reference for our listeners, the rapier would be the sword that we see in the movies like The Three Musketeers, for example.
Yes. I mean, films, I mean, the cross sword is double-handed, is sort of like the film Braveheart, for example, and most other medieval films, and the rapier musketeer style. The armor is full of rapiers. We have a very rich collection of rapiers, and they're beautiful swords. Some are high-end makes from Toledo and from famous, like the armor, there are famous names. One is Piccinino, is apparently a very famous sword maker, and we have loads of them.
And you would recognize this by their design or shape, or their sign, or there is something, or mark?
No, a maker's mark. No, they made an effort to put their mark on it.
Well deserved, I guess. And is there any particular swords in the collection in Malta that have some particular decoration which is worth of mentioning, perhaps?
We have some beautiful swords in the armory, and most of them, the rapier, what's important to say, evolved mostly, it flourished in the 17th century, and that was a time when a sword was useless in battle. So, from the Great Siege, the sword played a role when one was at close quarters. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it was cannons and firearms. But when we got to the 17th century, 1600s, the sword became a fashion item, and it was a civilian weapon, basically. And being a civilian weapon, and having fashion, they were beautifully decorated. Mm-hmm. And if you were a knight, a noble knight, you wanted a nicely decorated sword on your belt. So The armor has quite a few beautiful decorated swords. I mean, both in the number of rings around the handle and the hand grip, and also when the Spanish cup-hilt sword was invented, which is a rapier, and instead of having rings, you have a cup.
Okay.
Protecting the whole hand.
It looks less decorated, but it's just one piece of steel, kind of.
It's very practical, because ultimate protection for the hand. And it looks less decorated, but if you see some cup-hilt swords at the armory, that creates a space where one can put beautiful etchings in. And you know, there's some... The few cup-hilts in the armory in Valletta, they're very nicely decorated, so they belong to someone important who didn't want a plain cup.
Mm-hmm. Maybe to speak a bit more about a parading sword and a sword that is used during the battle. And for example, in Malta we have this issue of the Lavalette sword being at the Louvre, but that's the parade sword, right? And the real fighting sword, we still have it in Malta.
Exactly. I mean, the tradition says that there's a sword at the Museum of the St. Lawrence Parish in Burgo. Mm-hmm. It's mentioned that the valet, the tradition says, went to this chapel and left his sword at the chapel of Our Lady of Damascus as an ex voto.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very basic, very tough battle side sword. A side sword is a modern term for a battle rapier. So it is a sword with some rings around the hand, practical enough to protect your fingers, but nothing too elaborate. It has some nice decoration on the blade. There's a rosary etched on the blade, so it hints at being belonging to someone religious.
Mm-hmm.
It was very common in those times to put a rosary, but
blade was also sometimes decorated.
Yes. Mm-hmm. One would have some etching on the blade, but not much for practical swords. Mm-hmm. And that is a very basic military sword. And the valet was a very basic military man, so it matches the character. There's the famous sword that Philip II of Spain gave as a prize to the valet when the siege was won, and that was the Lavalette sword of the Louvre, basically, that Napoleon took as his own, because it belonged to a Frenchman. And that was totally not practical. It was never used for battle, I suspect. Heavily decorated.
Mm-hmm.
The design was nearly the same. The basic shape, but obviously it's full of rubies and stones and gold plated. And so a sword is a status symbol, so it's used as a symbol.
And nowadays, one would still find anyone who would be able to produce a sword, but in the traditional old way of doing a sword.
Yes. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to do our training.
So your training weapons are done as real?
Yes, as close as possible. In Malta, there isn't anyone who... It would have to be a swordsmith, basically. Mm-hmm. There are numerous international companies that produce swords, and there are some very good swordsmiths that do it the traditional way. Mostly in Italy, in America, in Spain, and in the UK. The ones that I know of, but there are many others. Incidentally, we got a swordsmith, Marco Danelli, in London, to make a recreation of the Devalet sword of Burgo, as close as possible. We measured it, we weighed it, and he made it as close as possible to the real thing. As Franco Navarro was saying, the armor, the sword died down when military technology increased.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like with armor, the sword sort of, the use in the military aspects started to die down as well. It became more civilian. Noble people insisted on wearing the swords more as tradition in the 18th century. But then the sword kept its symbolic function, you could say, up to today. in symbolism of, you know, when you say a sword, it means nobility and justice and things like that. So the two aspects of the sword, one died down, the other one sort of remained quite alive.
One last curiosity, actually, the dagger, because it's a weapon that really intrigues me a lot. It's small, it's easy to conceal, and it's also the ideal weapon to finish off a knight who fell during battle, because he would not be able to get up again, because of the weight of the armor.
A dagger was the secondary weapon of choice, both in the civilian aspect, when a nobleman would be walking around, having a rapier on his side and a dagger at the back. And you would use it as a secondary weapon along with the blade. So in both hands, one hand the blade and one hand the dagger. And the dagger would be there to defend strikes, and you finish off and you strike with the long weapon. But also, as you said, in armor fighting, exactly, I mean, when the going gets pretty nasty and it becomes into a wrestling match, because battle fighting is not nice, it's not what you see in Hollywood. Well, some Hollywood films are quite realistic now, but it's, you know, there's, okay, fighting with long swords and clashing, and then it boils down mainly always down to hand-to-hand and rolling around on the ground. A long sword would be useless then. If a knight has a dagger on his belt, it's the obvious thing to use, and it would be, yes, stabbing into the edges of the armor, in the neck area and the underarms, wherever the plates can't cover.
Cool. If someone wants to join the association, maybe you have a website you want to share or a Facebook link?
If you search Historical Fencing Malta on the search engine or on Facebook, it pops up immediately. The website is www.historicalfencingmalta.org. And there's all the information there anyway. We will meet twice a week and we try and make studying history fun.
Good. So, thank you so much for joining us today, Franco Navarro and Franco Davis. This has been very, very interesting, and I'm sure our listeners have enjoyed it as much as me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us, and I hope that you found all this information useful and interesting. And I remind you that you can download podcasts of all these programs from the website MaltaUniversityBroadcasting.com by choosing the webcasts tab, and from there you can choose Savoir Faire. Join us next week for more Savoir Faire.